I don't know how to play, and I don't want to anyway. Need to delete this game and go back to another save. But my hard drive sparked zero charisma, zero luck. I don't have any skills or the XP to fix my
Hello, and welcome to iLetter Media, presented by the National Institute for Gamer Review. I am DK.
I am Lewis, and come with me, and you'll be in a podcast about Slavic conflagrations. Dun, dun. Actually, no, not this time.
This time, no, we are continuing the, yes. On that note, so have you seen the South Park parody of Imagination Land? They did a funny bit.
I have seen Imagination Land. That's one of the original like edgy things. They did, right?
Yes, it was. But we'll get into all that. I guess today our topic, we'll have to see how the discussion goes. It was because I still haven't, you know, life with kids is always, you know, it's a pain in the ass sometimes in terms of watching things like Scarface. It's not the easiest thing to do. So but I guess the story here is Siege Baby, who's now Siege Boy, he's right on the cusp of, you know, proper boyhood, and so he had encountered the new Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, first with Johnny Depp, and then they did a thing with Timothy Chalamet, which I don't know, it was one of these things that, well, whatever. They're both pretty bad, each in their own way.
Sorry.
No. What?
Do you remember my gobstopper? Do you remember me? I remember your gobstopper. Sorry. I had to do a Dune reference.
Oh yes, right. Well, that's so like.
Sorry.
Yeah, Timothy Chalamet.
Walk Atreides.
And it's so strange that they're trying to make him like the it guy, I guess, right now. I mean, I guess he's just some fucking twink. Like, it's
these British twinks. It's him and it's Spider-Man.
Right. That's exactly right. That's the and I guess that's what they're going for now. Like, we, you know, the Jews are like, we have Brad Pitt at home. You know, Brad Pitt at home is his fucking twink or something. I don't know.
Well, they're all like 4'11" too. It's really bizarre.
So anyway, I was like, look, you gotta see the original. I mean, you know, this is not, there's no comparison to be drawn. One thing I will say about the Timothy Chalamet, the newest one, is that at least the songs are catchy. There is a kind of they put some effort into the musical aspect of it, but the whole thing is ruined. Basically, like, there's just niggers all over late Victorian, early whatever, you know, like it's, you know, deliberately obscure, but this essentially niggers where they don't belong in England, and this whole kind of subplot revolves around this little nigger girl, and it's like, please stop, just why, just no. And of course it has issues beyond that, but anyway, I was like, look, no, we gotta watch the original, and there was some resistance. Especially when, you know, I showed the trailer, and it was kind of, you know, the, I guess it was made 1971, which is really essentially the 60s, particularly from a technological perspective. So yeah, the film itself, the quality looked kind of off by contemporary oversaturated sensibilities and things like that. But when we actually sat down to watch it, he was entranced, which is not.
Well, sorry, you mentioned the film grain really, really quickly. New films are just way too dark in general. Mm-hmm. And I think older films look better, especially like just because of they're just not, like, you can tell it's a set more, but it's also just like things are more visible on screen, period. So,
well, one thing that stuck out was there were some aspects of it that were clearly, you know, for film, but on the whole, it was essentially produced as a stage musical. And that wasn't uncommon, especially in the early days of cinema, where the production and just the way things were shot, there were a lot more static frames, actors kind of moving around. You didn't have a cut every 5 seconds, right? You had sets that actors would walk around on, as you know, blocked as they would be on a stage. And so that was definitely interesting. And it's one of these things that you've seen a million times as a kid, and it's just kind of in the cultural drinking water, which is why things like the South Park Imagination Land episode hit. But I hadn't kind of sat down and watched the whole thing as a kind of like an artistic film experience, maybe ever. You know, even when you're a kid, you're just kind of watching movies just to watch them. And yeah, there were, in particular, I think the scene where Willy Wonka first comes out of the chocolate factory is really long and kind of slow. You know, Gene Wilder kind of he comes out on a cane. It's been built up as this big mysterious moment. He's sort of stumbling on his cane, and he laboriously inches down the carpet, the purple carpet or whatever, until he reaches the end, the gate, and then he does this little flip and tumble, and he's, you know, oh, I'm actually spry after all, and throws away the cane. But it's a good, I don't know, 20, 30 seconds of just still, just, you know, everybody's standing still except for Gene Wilder, who's literally kind of hobbling on a cane for a while, yeah.
Movies were just more, I think, more willing to do some build at a certain point. Like, if you even watch, like, the original Star Wars films, there's just, like, people talking scenes in the beginning, like,
that was Luke
talking to his boring parents about, like, boring farm shit.
Right.
You know, like,
yeah, exactly. Well, no, that was the note I had in my mind. It's half an hour, almost a quarter of the movie's runtime before you're even in the factory. Like, everything up to that is this, you know, sort of tongue-in-cheek satire of everybody trying to get the golden tickets. And it's kind of ambiguous. Like, I'd never really thought about it logically before. But in the mold of, yes, you know, red-letter media and N-letter media, now I-letter media, asking sort of questions about, like, okay, so you have this chocolate factory that's so famous that he sends his chocolates all over the world. And I had forgotten about this little bit, but there's a brief fake out where the last golden ticket is said to go to some like Colombian drug lord gambling magnate. And then it turns out he forged it. But in the meantime, they're doing kind of fake news reports showing, you know, putting pins in different places. Like, for the first golden ticket goes, which I had forgotten this character entirely, the German boy, the fat German boy.
Yes.
I remember the song.
You forgot Augustus Gloop?
Okay, so I remembered, like, the part where he falls in the chocolate river. And, of course, I remember, you know, eating as much as an elephant eats. Like, this is, you know, indelible in the hippocampus, as as they say. But no, I forgot that he was specifically German, and that, you know, because like when they find him, he's in a Bavarian hunting lodge. It's all, that was another kind of thing that stuck out, is we can, you know, this is 1971, less than 30 years after the war is over, and we're doing kind of good-natured, not even ribbing of sort of stock German stereotypes. It was, you know, but it was before the Holocaust had been invented, right? That was a few years later in the 1970s. But yeah, no, I remembered, of course, Veruca Salt and I didn't remember her name, but the bubblegum girl, and who turned into a
Mike. You know, remember Mike TV, the American?
Yeah, I remember. I don't remember his thing being TV so much. Although,
so
that makes
they
sense.
They toned him down in all the theatrical productions, because I think it's like almost too biting and vicious.
He's just a straight, he is your AmeriFat Burgeroid. Like, he's just,
yeah,
like,
but in the book they have like the original Roald Dahl illustrated, like the doodles, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
The famous Roald Dahl doodles. He is like, it's a weird, like, he's very tall relative to the other children, and he's covered in like, he's wearing basically a vest or a onesie made of like transistors and shit, like, and like TV screens. Like, he's a...
He's a tech guy. Yeah.
You know, he's like... Well, he's like become... Yes, he is like... Almost like, you know, TV is his identity. You know, like, he is TV.
Which
like
was more so the case in the Depp movie, I will say. Because in the 71 with Gene Wilder adaptation, it's... He's basically just... he does the cowboy hat and fake revolver thing.
Yeah,
and,
bang, bang. He's just a kind of a slightly obnoxious kid.
But he's also kind of... Well, at least, I will say the character as portrayed in the Depp version at least sort of, you know, he points out the inherent absurdity of... Like, he's... If you've actually invented this invention that you can move a chocolate bar from one end of the room to the other, then, you know... First of all, that's impossible, but if it is possible, that's human teleportation. And it's much more kind of technologically oriented, presented a little bit smarter than just this literal TV watching. Like, the Mike TV character in the 71 adaptation basically grew up to be your normie, like, CNN/Fox News watcher.
Yeah.
Like,
that's well, also, he's also portrayed as younger than the other kids, mm-hmm. and, like, more immature. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Roald Dahl version has him, like, older, almost like 14-ish, it seems, or by the illustrations and descriptions, which is, I think, what's it? Roald Dahl was more cutting. 71, it's for Americans, you know, so I think the American kid gets off relatively easy.
Okay, so speaking of, back to nationality, because I didn't finish the thought. Yeah, so that was the thing. So you have this chocolate factory at this ambiguous, like, it's kind of, I guess, implied. It's not really clear. Because it's clearly like a small town-ish in America, which we understand is, you know, really like a small town in England in the book originally would have been, something like that. But it's also, so it's a place you can go in a small town. It's just like the factory that's like our local factory.
Well, it's Hershey, Pennsylvania. That's the bit.
Is it? It's Hershey. Okay, I guess that makes sense.
Well, because it's like a somewhat medium to larger-sized town. There are other, also in the book references other, I think it's actually, even the original book might be a little bit more about Hershey than are inspired by, because like it references there's rival chocolatiers in the town too.
Yes, that's exactly
which for Hershey I think there was, right, or something like that. Like there's
that's region. A whole other, like, I mean, that would make maybe for a good culture tear or something at some point, and I would have
the
to
chocolate,
do some
research, yeah, the chocolate wars,
the chocolate wars, and just Hershey being like among the worst and most exploitative capitalist shithole companies in human existence ever.
But also, like, the industrial genius of being able to use expired milk to make chocolate before 1950 gives you such a massive market advantage that, like, you can take over the world, you know?
And now the
like,
goys love it, right? The goys are so used to, this is one of my favorite 4chan texts of all time, but I believe it's true that the, essentially, it's not an accident that Hershey dark chocolate isn't bad. But the Hershey milk chocolate has that some kind of sour, something's like off. And yes, it's because back in the day when, you know, they figured out a way to use essentially expired milk, sour milk is part of the process, and people got used to it. And Americans will get used to literally any degradation. They're just like, ugh, whatever. I don't want to rag on Americans too hard, but I feel Mike's been talking lately about, you know, just with the Israel thing and how just completely degraded the state of, like, Americans, just American normies deserve all the shit they get and worse. So I don't feel that bad, but chocolate is a kind of mini, you know, a microcosm of what's wrong with America and what's wrong with Americans, which, yeah, speaks to the, I guess, moral message of the. Of the, what do you want to call it, the media property, the Wonka cinematic universe?
Or like people who are, I guess the Roald Dahl estate just licenses it out to whoever's the highest bidder, right? Like
at this point, sure. They don't seem particularly preoccupied with maintaining any kind of artistic integrity.
Or continuity of, like, you know, there will never be a Wonka 2 or whatever, you know. Or, you know, so. Also, things get weird. Like that second...
Read the second book, with the elevator.
Things get more like psychedelic and weird, like as books did back then, and also Wonka, the first one has hints of the psychedelics, and the movie especially, even like...
Well, the movie, I think, not just hints, the movie was, I think, a major trendsetter for psychedelic culture in the 70s. It wasn't just... I mean, in other words, this is a piece of artistic media that kind of defined a whole aesthetic.
It also was defined by being played over and over again on TV forever. Yeah. Forever.
Yeah. Well, that was back in the day. That was literally, you know, that was what was it? The first video cassette recording for home use, which is of course prohibitively expensive for most people, wasn't even released until I think 77 or 78, something like that. So, and then it didn't really take off until the 80s. So, yeah, it was just something like, and then you had, this was also the era of, you know, three TV channels. And if they were going to play a movie, there was a good chance this was going to be the movie that they were going to be playing. And yeah, so people just saw it over and over and over again. Yeah, it was funny seeing I mean, of course, I'd seen it before again, but when he says, you know, the snozzberries taste like snozzberries, which is now just kind of a, you know, what, just like a part of stoner culture that shows up in, what was it, Super Troopers? And not just that, but lots of other, it's so iconic. I mean, that was the one of the funny things rewatching it is, you know, you sort of, you have this memory of it and you know where these lines come from, but then to see it in its original context is always interesting.
Yeah. Well, also the how much of American pop culture was set by a certain amount of a certain few movies being replayed over and over and over again, right? Like, It's a Wonderful Life, you know, mm-hmm. was probably notorious for the 12 Angry Men. Like, these were movies that were played on TV before the invention of, like, you know, recorded, like, you know, it was the theater or this. You didn't have home cinema, right? You just had what was on TV. And
I will say, I think that's part of, because we talked about this before in terms of, we did, you know, the Starship Troopers episode, and I had never, like, sat through the whole thing. That was a big part of the reason why is I'm old enough to have not grown up with streaming. So this idea that you can just, there's a movie you want to watch that you haven't seen before, you know, okay, yes, there was a time where you could go to the Blockbuster, right? But even there, you're somewhat hampered by what do they have available, what's checked out, what's new, what's not. And then there's a whole hassle of, like, do you even have a VCR? If you do, is it on the family TV? If you're 14 years old, can you rent Scarface and watch it by, you know, on the family TV? No, probably, you know? So it's, yeah, the interface between technology and media and culture is definitely part of the story, has to be part of the analysis.
Yeah, and also just, I think, because our parents watched it and liked it, like, there were multiple times in my life where I would just get called downstairs or called from my room or, hey, you just come home from whatever, we're watching the show, it's on CBS or whatever.
Yeah,
you know,
sure,
it's a Thursday night, like, you're going to watch Charlie's Rocketeer, you're like, okay, this is fine, this movie's good enough. It's like, these movies are good enough that you can do that, you know, I will enjoy this product.
It is definitely a really good film. I mean, I was struck by how, I mean, okay, yes, it does drag a little bit in the first
act. The end actually is the most draggy, I think. The beginning and the end, they're,
well, the very end draggy. Is also just very abrupt. I mean, it kind of,
yeah,
just it kind of wants to be a 3-hour movie, but there was just no way that was going to happen. So they kind of reach a certain point, like, I guess we got to call it there, whatever. And just sort of end it in the glass elevator, which just it was striking how it really came out of, correct me if I'm wrong, because it sounds like you remember the book better than I do. I remember there were, like, at least one or two offhand references to it, if I recall correctly, through the book. It didn't just appear in the last two pages. Not that it, I guess, matters too much, but it's just sort of this very strange deus ex, not even deus ex machina, just like, here we go, let's launch into space.
Well, it's a sequel hook, you know?
Sure.
And things get weird. Like the, there is talk of, like, they basically, I really think it's probably one of the earliest, sequel hooks that just didn't pan out. Like, I don't know how it didn't pan out. I actually don't know how commercially, like, how many tickets this thing sold.
Why wouldn't they have made another film?
Well, I don't know how many times. I don't know how many tickets. A lot of these products, like It's a Wonderful Life and 12 Angry Men, didn't actually sell that many tickets. Mm. Like, they, it's like the, it's not a cult hit, but it's like, this thing was licensed to CBS or a big three broadcaster.
Oh, yeah, and so it made money in syndication.
And got played until,
yeah,
it was
sure,
famous.
Sure,
not,
sure, yeah.
Like, I know It's a Wonderful Life had some rights issue that happened where, like, the actual producers of it didn't make the money off of it. Like the CBS had some part owner. I don't know what the, like, a lot of these films had some, like, behind-the-scenes weirdness where they were actually free for one of the big three to just play and fill time. I don't know what happened to this one, but it could have been just like, you know, licensed to whoever at an affordable rate that it could be repeatedly played.
Yeah, I'm just looking it up now. The Wikipedia says the film was not a big success, eventually earning $4 million worldwide on a $3 million budget, and was the 24th highest grossing film of the year in North America.
So a failure, basically. Yeah.
25% return is nothing in, I mean, that's not counting all those stuff. And that's marketing eventual and worldwide gross, which like you would expect to make, like if you don't making double your budget domestically within a month or two, your film's basically a failure as far as Hollywood's concerned. Yeah. So yeah, that makes sense.
A lot of these films like that, like these seminal American classics or whatever the fuck you want to call them, like it's the same way movies would get big on, like, you know, DVD release or just word of mouth. It's
cult classics, as they call them. Yes.
Yeah, but like, no, you can't quite call it that because it's being played on, like, it's like being broadcast on like one of three TV channels. So
yeah,
it's something like that. It's with a tail. I think it's also just really, like, it's also really like just good. And I've never done this because I don't have that autism. I bet there's a TV cut of it that's actually better because it is long as hell.
Yeah, it drags. That's what was
I'm sure said, there's a TV because when I watched as a kid,
100 minutes.
It's the they get the factory pretty quick, like just by my child recollection of it.
That was why it was so striking to me watching it. I was like, wow, it's been 20 minutes and they're still looking for tickets. I would have thought we would.
There has to be a TV cut that's like a bit tighter, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you would expect.
Just because also it's like 3 hours. Yeah, like you would have to, if it's almost 3 hours, right?
Yeah, the running time is it says 100 minutes, but that's, I mean, it felt like longer, I guess. Oh, well. And definitely it's I think you weren't in the factory until almost half an hour had elapsed. So yeah, another thing that struck me was the Oompa Loompas, of course, steal the show, but they really have very little screen time. Much less than, like,
which is accurate to the book, I think, actually too.
Yes, but not to my childhood recollection, where they kind of dominate the mental scene of or the memory of this film, for all the obvious reasons. But yeah, they're just kind of,
well, they are also always in the background, kind of just like doing stuff in the factory.
That's true.
You know, like they don't like have any lines, but they're like they are around. Also, it was probably the last decade where you could get like 25 midgets for anything, you know.
Yeah, in the
now you get like one, maybe two.
They don't even do that. It was, and I will again, another good the Chalamet adaptation was I think on balance it's like an origin story, which of course we have to do a dark, gritty reboot origin story for Willy Wonka because that's just where we are in the current year plus whatever it was 2 years ago. But it was Hugh Grant was the Oompa Loompa. They did like CGI magic to make him a little person, and it was actually great. Like he did very well.
I wonder when we get next Wonka. So in the original Wonka, they're just like cannibal niggers.
Yeah,
and he's retrained to eat chocolate, right?
Yeah, yeah.
At what point do you not just make them like niggers again? Right, like it's right there. Right,
well, they
like,
kind of did that with the Chalamet, like the Hugh Grant's character arc in the film. Like, I didn't pay super close attention because I was like, why are there niggers in England 100 years ago? Just no. But the whole thing was basically Hugh Grant somehow allowed, like, Willy Wonka went on an adventure, found these special cocoa beans in Oompa Loompa land and took some with him, whereas Hugh Grant, Oompa Loompa, had been somehow charged with protecting them, and so he had to go like get them back, and in the course of working this out, or he would essentially be, and I'd have to look up the maybe I could do that while you filibuster, but the line in the film in the song essentially was like, they're going to kill me and eat me if I don't get these like magic cocoa beans back. And that's like the other big plot driver for the film, other than like little
that's
niggers.
That's kind of funny, actually.
Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. It goes right hand in hand with what you're saying.
That's funky, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. It's not about the everlasting gobstopper, is it? It's about the
we could talk about the do you have thoughts on the symbology of the everlasting gobstopper or
yeah, so he's doing Henry Ford shit. Like
yes.
There's this mythology around like I don't know. People of Roald Dahl is older. He's old as he's relatively old as writing these books, right? I believe. You know, there's this mythology around people who, like, say, born in the pre-World War II society, that certain like philosopher capitalists, if you will, to use the bugoid term, are trying to do a good job, and they are like trying to improve the world, and there are these rich great men trying to do stuff. But they're just being constantly fucked over by, like, their rivals. And, like, Henry Ford is kind of the example of this with the original shareholder value Supreme Court case where it was actually revealed that – or not revealed. It was determined by, you know, the American
– by Jews.
The American establishment that, you know, shareholders have, like, obligations to, to each other and to other owners – to make as much money as they can, irrespective of like things like anything else, like other than like compliance with the law, you have to pay your employees as little as possible, produce as shitty a product as possible. The gobstopper is probably more analogous to, like, I guess like a car engine that doesn't fucking break, right? Like your old or something like that. Like it's like these products that don't wear out, right? And there was this hope in that pre-World War II era, or I guess even into the 50s, that like.
To be kind of theoretical about it, it's a definitional luxury consumable. It's literal candy, but I guess the conceit is that you never need to. It's never consumed.
You have to buy it again, right?
You never have to buy it again, even though it's like it's not like a fridge or a computer that's going to have something like planned obsolescence or that people are going to complain about, as opposed to the good old days where they built things to last, blah blah blah.
But it is about that too, like, right? It is
of
that.
Course,
yeah.
But unlike, you know, durable goods, as they say, this is literally a consumable. Yeah. Yes. that cannot be consumed. Yeah,
and he's being sabotaged by his rival chocolatiers, who he hates because they're just the Dodge brothers, who are these slimy, ambiguously Jewish money-making people who don't care about the consumer at all. They're trying to like fleece them. I mean, that's what it's about. It's about Walker is Ford, but it's like the good guy Ford, not that it, you know. And I think there's there's more going on there with Oompa Loompas. The Oompa Loompas are probably not actually like doing a replacement migration bit. It's kind of too early for that to be to make sense in the original Roald Dahl thing. That wasn't like an actual, maybe it's like a Wind Rush thing, but it doesn't really seem like it. It just seems like it's a funny kind of a gag. I don't think he's doing a Wind Rush statement of, but there is like some, oh, like the Wonka factory closed and still makes the chocolates, but like doesn't, the original thing is like, I think was it Grandpa Joe worked at the Wonka factory or people did in the town. That's why it's so poor, is because they fired all the employees.
Well,
industrial espionage, which is a Hershey reference,
exactly.
And then like they kept producing it somehow.
Yeah. So that was the mystery that set up is we used to employ the whole town in this factory, but that Slugworth just kept doing industrial espionage and stealing my techniques and whatever. So I had to fire everybody. And then, but I kept making the chocolate. We don't know how. And then when they invite the kids in, it turns out. The Oompa Loompas are doing it. Okay, so I have here two bits. I have the Oompa Loompa song, the lyrics from the 2020. I think it is actually literally the current year, or maybe it was 2020, late 2023. And then I have an article from December 15th, 2023, in the New York Times. Can the Oompa Loompas be saved? Wonka is the latest film to try and shake the tiny unpaid laborers from their colonialist roots in Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So the lyrics are Oompa Loompa Doompity Doo, I've got a tragic tale for you, blah blah blah. My job was guarding with what little we'd got. You came along and pinched the lot. I'm disgraced, cast out in the cold, till I've paid my friends back a thousandfold. And my, again, vague recollection is like the very much a threat on his life from these other like cannibal niggers in this thing. So yes, the New York Times notes in the original, in Dahl's original, the Oompa Loompas were starving African pygmies, subsisting largely on a mash of green caterpillars and tree bark until, quote-unquote, rescued by Willy Wonka. He smuggled the entire...
What do you mean, quote-unquote? They were starving. pity the poor Negro.
Right. Well, yeah.
Oh, sorry. I had to, like,
No, absolutely.
I have to be revolted because it's like...
Well, it's funny because Roald Dahl himself, who we haven't even... I mean, again, this is why I think there's just enough to chew on here, and Roald Dahl and the Roald Dahl cinematic universe is big enough and interesting enough, and I have lots of things I could say, and I would also want to refresh my memory, and because this also sparked Siege Baby's imagination. Do this whole there was a magical moment where he was like, "So what happened to Charlie after he goes in the elevator with Willy Wonka?" And I said, "Well, there's a book about that." He's like, "What?" I'm like, "Yeah," because I had already, you know, being the kind of parent and fan of literature, et cetera, that I am, I'd already purchased for him a Roald Dahl box set. So he went up and I showed him, you know, "Yeah, I have this set. There are all these books you can read." And he's like, you know, his mind was kind of blown. And Roald Dahl is great. And there's there's a lot that we could say about Roald Dahl, and we will, I think, in future episodes. But at this time, yeah, the comparison I wanted to make was between Roald Dahl and Rudyard Kipling. It's very similar kind of Chad Anglo phenotype. And, you know, very much not just a talented writer and teller of stories.
More depth than they get credit for.
Way more, yeah. And
both of those guys, extremely, there's a lot more going on there.
Yeah. And Dahl is very much in this mold of the 19th century British explorer, self-sufficient thing. So it wouldn't be weird. He's not going to think twice about, like, "Oh, yeah, we have some starving cannibal niggers. Like, why don't we..." Like, the right thing to do is Rudyard Kipling-style white man's bird, right? Like, that's
the... Yeah, but then eat, like, people food, you know? Like,
right, yeah. But the New York Times in the current year is like, "Oh, no. Yeah, it's just funny. They have a quote from Dahl. Quote, "It didn't occur to me that my depiction of the Oompa Loompas was racist," Dahl said in a 1988 interview. "But it did occur to the NAACP and others." And then they go on. It's a really quiet. I'll see if I can mine for some more quotes in here. But that was, I mean, that's, I guess, kind of the main. Oh, yeah. Scholars have criticized Dahl's children's books for decades, calling out instances of racist and sexist stereotypes. This year, that was right. That was when I bought I remember. This year, Puffin Books ignited a firestorm when it released new versions of Dahl's classics, including Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Matilda, that removed, among other things, references to skin color, body size, and slavery. For years, biographers have taken on Dahl himself, calling out his self-professed anti-Semitism. I didn't know about that. I have to look into that. I mean, I didn't even know. I like him even more now. Yeah, and I already had a very high opinion. And his stunningly cruel mistreatment of his first wife, the Academy Award-winning actress Patricia Neal. Yeah, whatever. So when I remember there was this, yes, firestorm about their removing, like, the fat girl, like, when the fat guy and the stuff about being fat from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, they were taking all that shit out. I'm like, that's the fucking point. Like, are you kidding me?
So it's also more poignant and needed than ever before.
Right. Which is why they're removing it, of course.
Yeah. So, well, all Dahl's critiques, well, I guess the Vruga Salt one actually is kind of doesn't really quite hit as hard.
The
TV stuff
spoiled
and
children.
The other one is, what's the other kid spoiled too? That, like, I don't know, the rich parents.
The other thing was that in the movie they don't point the finger at Veruca; they point the finger at her dad. Which they say, "We know," and the whole Oompa Loompa song for that bit is, you know, "We know who to blame," and then the mother and the father, mother and the father. You know, like, we don't blame the kids; we blame you. You know, so that was definitely. Definitely great. No, so yeah, it was in the middle of this, and I saw, like, holy shit, there's, like, they're bastardizing Roald Dahl. I better get all the, I guess I have to buy physical copies of all the old Roald Dahl before they did this shit now. And that's when I bought that box set, and then so that I had it to present to Siege Boy, when, you know, to blow his mind. You're like, yeah, you know, you can read these books and they're great. You know, like, there's more adventures to be had.
Oh, yeah. But the, I don't know, Roald Dahl, I actually have never, he is, it seems like, I guess you're probably for kids, like, there's anti-Semitic stuff you can read into them, but, like, he is, like, he uses just, like, traditional, like, British evil guy names, like Slugworth, you know? Right. Like, he's not doing, like, he's not, like, ripping off, like, he's not, like, fighting against Chocolateberg, you know, or something like that. Like, it's pretty, tasteful, I guess. But, eh, whatever. Yeah, it's almost like, I don't know, to his other work, it's very much about just, like, as the libs say, just being a decent person, you know, like, just, like, the moral of every Roald Dahl story is just, like, just be nice, like, please just be nice, almost universally, and, like, also...
more than, I mean, be generous, be kind, be moderate, be courteous. It's not just, I mean, not, maybe this is just my own thing. I really hate the word nice, I think, and I know you're not using it exactly in that way, but... like, nice is the Reddit religion, you know? The religion of Reddit is being nice. Like, don't be an asshole, be nice. And I just, that's not even close to be... nice people are some of the worst people on the planet. Nice Redditors, nice Amerifats, you know, nice libtards are among the worst people on the planet, often. And, you know, nice is not a virtue. Kindness is a virtue, generosity is a virtue, etc., right?
Yes, but generally, like, it is a very British, like, you know, effect of, like, you know, you, like, well, they, like, for instance, the British would see kindness and, like, and it is pathological, perhaps, but, oh, like, I must save these cannibal niggers from their malnourishment of whatever, right? Like, that's the British, like, I don't know, guys, I think, I don't know.
I have to look back over this because there's another.
It's true. No, that's part of it. It's like they ate tree bark and caterpillars. He teaches them about eating like cacao.
Human food, right? Yeah.
No, well, I think they eat like the chocolate seed or chocolate, like the beans. Eat candy. They eat the beans. It's like, oh, and then it's like the Wookiee life debt thing. Like, oh, you've shown us like how to eat real food. Our entire culture is yours to command, kind of thing.
Here's another paragraph from the New York Times article. So it's little wonder that when the creators of the 1971 film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, starring Gene Wilder, first adapted Dahl's story, they ran as fast and far as they could from the book's, quote, happy slave narrative with its with its singing,
no, they didn't.
Grinning black workers dressed only in skins and leaves. I've forgotten that detail. Toiling for next to nothing in a place they never leave. Which, yeah, that part is... I mean, yes, they're basically like... They're cannibal niggers with green wigs and dwarfism. And I guess...
Like, also, but, like, Roald Dahl may be doing some stuff. Like, well, you know, like, this... Oh, yeah. Like, because he's doing, like, a very British pre-World War II anti-colonialism bit there, right? Of, like, mm-hmm. Oh, they...
Yeah.
But, white like, man's it's burden. Not so,
that's,
retarded.
Like, literally 19th century white man's burden kind of morale.
Yeah, like, we shouldn't make them toil forever, but, like, also... They seem happy, and it's probably better than the alternative. You know, like, it's one of those, you know, you see libertarians actually drop this out every once in a while. They talk about, like, sweatshops in the third world.
Where they
bring up the point, which is a true point, that of the two third world jobs, which are peasant and, like, sweatshop worker, the sweatshop worker is a prefer by, like, we can tell this by a revealed preference that they prefer to work in the sweatshops than, like, in agriculture, because it fucking sucks being a third-world farmer. True. But you still probably shouldn't exploit them. You know, like the libertarians are like, okay, so obviously real preference means we can just open infinity sweatshops. But the answer is actually no, you have to be, like, somewhat, like they will work forever. It doesn't mean you should work them like that, right?
Is Wonka mistreating them? I mean, I missed that part. You know, they seem to like they get to sing and dance and eat chocolate all day, except for the 2 minutes where they're, you know, pulling a paddle boat by hand or something.
Yeah, And they did have a pre choreographed these songs, so they're right. clearly in on the joke, as
right.
it were.
Right.
But they all, I don't know. It's there's stuff going on, but also it's like one of the things where you shouldn't actually think to, it is for like four kids, like getting too deep into Roald Dahl stuff is like no, it's actually it's like just entertaining to some degree.
Oh,
like
he's just telling. Yes, he's self-consciously telling stories for children, to children.
With good morals, but that's he's not like doing hyper depth. I think Henry Sugar is probably the best example. Have you read Henry Sugar?
I don't think so. No,
I would say that's his most adult work. Well, no, he has some very, very adult stuff that's like kind of like almost gets too weird. But Henry Sugar is about a guy who gets through a certain number of ways a superpower that he can.
Oh no, I did. Yes. Actually, there was a Netflix adaptation with Benedict Cumberbatch written and directed by Wes Anderson that I'm not like a huge fan of either of them, but is actually quite good. And it's just straight up like the it's just the story just essentially read by Benedict Cumberbatch.
Yeah. It's basically a morality play about like, well, like it's like kind of the, a response. I think it might actually be a conscious response to the, Twilight Zone episode about the guy in hell who can't lose.
Yeah. I'm sure it's somewhere like, yeah.
Yeah. Where it's kind of that, but it's about like how to, okay, like, well, if you achieve success, how do you become happy after that? And it's in the very British heads, like opening hospitals and orphanages with money you steal from casinos, which is pretty fun. But it's more about like, but it's, that's
well, that story
that's
is
getting we, yeah, a more direct morality play. Like he gets there's a point where he's like specifically told off by a police. Well, also symbol of British of authority. It's a policeman. Like he wins a bunch of money. He realizes it's fucking pointless for like the millionth time. He wins a bunch of money in cards, and he has like £20,000 in like 1950s money, which is like
enormous amounts of money. Yeah.
And he throws it out the penthouse window, and there's like a kind of causes a mini riot. And he's like, I wish, and the policeman like knocks on his door and yells at him, like, you thought you were trying to cause happiness, young man, but actually, you caused trouble. And like, why don't you give it to widows and orphans?
I would have to from track the war. Down the actual line, because yeah. it was quite a good line. But yes, it was basically like, the police was like, you rich fucks all think alike. You think that, you know, generosity is just, you have no concept of what, you know, money is actually worth, so it's just worth nothing to you, so you throw it out your balcony like, you know, ticker tape, like toilet paper. And he's like, well, what should I do with it instead? He's like, don't give it to just whatever asshole is greedier than the others and can scoop it up off the ground. Give it to widows and orphans. And the other quick thing on Henry Sugar, because we mentioned Rudyard Kipling, is he didn't just acquire this magic power. He developed it over a period of years by practicing a meditation technique that he learned during his travels in India, which is kind of a fun. I was like, oh wow, that's really, you know, he's talking with the naked guru type who didn't want anything to do with him, and eventually was like, okay, you know, when he was eventually kind of impressed by his dedication to wanting to learn, Guruji was like, yeah, okay, I'll teach you this one thing, then you have to go back, leave India forever, you know, go back to England. Like, okay, so it's just kind of a funny. There's this colonialism is definitely hanging in the air. And I say that neutrally. Obviously, British colonization of India was among the best things that have ever happened to India, and honest Indians will admit it. It doesn't mean they belong in English-speaking countries in the West. It just means that India is an English-speaking country. Officially, it's an official language, and much better off for it.
I believe it's a novella or a short story. If you're listening to this and you're like not a kid anymore, I would recommend you.
No, it's quite good. Yes, Henry Sugar is very good. Yeah. Or just watch. Honestly, if you have if you're a subscriber, I mean, or you could just whatever. Not even, you know, there's a million ways to pirate shit off Netflix. It's like whatever 20-30 minutes. It's basically the story as narrated by a contemporary British actor who's pretty good at his job. So yeah, it's. Good stuff. One other. Okay, so that all that also that all brings up one thing I wanted to talk about, which was also kind of obliquely an issue in the South Park parody, which is the pedophilia question, because it was really it was jarring. It was a kind of like, this is what they took from you kind of moment. Watching, especially the first scene, really, the first song is this song, you know, the Candyman. And then, you know, later made even more famous by Sammy Davis Jr. and, you know, been sampled and so on a million times. But when the titular Candyman, who is a literal Candyman, who runs a candy shop, and he has the kind of early 20th century, you know, the kind of uniform, and it was just the sort of, and of course, there's no one but children, unaccompanied children, in his candy shop. You got like whatever a dozen or so kids. I mean, like none of them is probably even teenaged, sitting at the stools, asking for candy, and this kind of middle-aged man, balding man, is giving the kids candy. It was like, you, number one, you could just never, no one would believe this scene today. Like, it's just not a thing that, like, you wouldn't have all these kids running around unaccompanied, and people would call 911 on this guy, you know, if he tried to open a shop like this or something. Not that it would be economically viable in the first place.
It's like a bar, but for like a bar, but for candy.
Exactly, yeah. Which candies. Is what that's how you used to back in the day before you could get Coca-Cola on, like, you know, from a refrigerator at Walmart. You had to get it pulled for you by a guy who had an expensive piece of equipment that dispensed it pretty much the same way you get beer from a tap. And that was the only way to get Coca-Cola or any other kind of fizzy drink, right? So yeah, it was this thing of like, I am mad at Jews for creating a society where this scene is ringing alarm bells. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like kids should be able to go to their local neighborhood candy shop and like eat candy with other kids and be provided his candy by a nice man who's, you know, very trustworthy and runs a good business and, you know, takes care, and he can't, the whole thing, you know, the candy man can, you know, makes the world taste good because he gives you stuff that tastes good and he gives it with love. Like, that's so nice, but it sounds like in the current year or current year plus eight, it sounds very, very wrong, you know?
Yeah. Also, there's a kind of a hidden, like a, I don't know what you call it, like a sub narrative going on with the, where it's very like, Roald, maybe it's a project, Roald Dahl is like pointing out, like, so the Candyman and Roald Dahl is like from this era, he makes the candy, like he's buying the raw materials and like,
yes, he's mixing it by hand, yes,
and he's kind of like the rival to Wonka, who is the big, like
the big industrialist,
right? And like everyone actually like, like he is like Wonka in the is actually a deeply unhappy man, and like that's kind of the whole thing is that, oh, Wonka is sad. But the big, like, I don't know, the yeoman Candyman is like happy and like makes everything great. Whereas Wonka, the big industrial, is like this kind of,
I've achieved success, but at what cost?
Yeah, he's not depraved, but he's not like, he's, you know, he's deeply unhappy with like his whole situation. Whereas the guy who's like slowly, you know, I don't know how you do it. Like, I guess I know it's a lot of baking, and like, who's pulling his peppermints individually is much more happy than the guy with the big factory. You know, there's that's which is very, it's very, well, British, like Tolkien. It's very, yes, Tolkien kind of thing. Like, oh, the
right,
the yeoman farmer, yes, is, yeah, happier, yeah, than, yeah, the, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Industrialization.
Oh, I fucking hate Tolkien, by the way. Oh,
me too. Well, that's, we'll have to do that. I was whatever.
I will get you back. Getting back on.
I don't want to get off track.
Twitter, currently known as Twitter.
Yes.
There's like all these fucking Tolkien posters.
I know.
And there was just, they were glorifying this one of these, like, someone at some point, I'm sorry, it's a tangent.
No, it's fine. Someone
asked Tolkien, like, who's, like, are you some case? Like, oh, no, I'm not that guy. I'm this other guy in the Fellowship, Formir or whatever. And Formir's, like, biggest line is, like, doesn't do much in the books. And he's like, I won't take the ring because I fear that if I was given power, I would do, like, good things with it, but it would be bad in the end. It's like, Oh, so you're a conservative. Like,
no, literally, that's why conservatives love Lord of the Rings. Literally why. I've been on this beat for years. And it was honestly when I first started really turning against Rod Dreher was when I started noticing how Rod Dreher had this tick. And it wasn't just him, but because he would cite also other people in exactly that same conservative milieu. And they all fucking love Tolkien because... And the tweet I saw on ex currently known as twitter.com was essentially someone saying the best part of Lord of the Rings is the ending, because the whole point of it is that like Frodo literally is incapable of throwing the ring in the fire because human will to power is incapable of achieving greatness or goodness. And everything has to be divine intervention and providence. Otherwise, you know, you never get off the ground. I'm like, yes, you thinking this, you conservative retards believing this, is exactly why I hate this fucking... And the movies were okay in spite of the source material. Like, Peter Jackson is a better storyteller than J.R.R. Tolkien. Sorry, yeah. It's just true.
Yeah, no, the death scene is better than any port, like the... whatever.
Oh. Yeah, that's all I'll say. But yes, this, but the I guess there is a comfy, cozy kind of pine tree gang.
That instinct of like, I like my Luddite paradise is not wrong. Like, I want to be a country gentleman.
Right.
I don't want to be a rich industrialist. It's like, it's true.
It's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. That's right. It's actually
now, if your pussy ass would take any action to preserve that, maybe I would give a fuck about your fucking. Right. Oh, you.
We'll have to do I'm not actually going to sit. I tried as a kid to read Lord of the Rings. I was bored to tears. I was like, this is fucking retarded. Like, this sucks so bad. And so I'll have to like figure out a way that we could do. We'll do it.
But I have read Lord of the Rings, but I believe I did like unfortunately tap out. Like, I think
last book. Like, it was at the 6 millionth time that they started breaking into song before actually like moving.
I didn't mind that. The Hobbit's actually great, by the way.
The Hobbit's fine. No, I like
because there's
the
will power. He takes the ring.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, not just... Yes, he's like an asshole. Like, no, this is mine now.
And the dwarves are all will to power as well. They're like, no, we're going to fight the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Tolkien somehow wasn't offended.
He took our shit, and we're going to get it back. Like,
which also comes to Tolkien as an ultra-Zionist fucking faggot, where it's like, well, the Jews can go fight. Like, right. Like, if you dwarves as the Jews, like, well, oh, they're going to do Zionism. They're going to do will to power. I would never do will to power, though. You fucking pussy. Sorry.
We'll have to do that. Yeah, we'll do that. Or maybe, I don't even know if, maybe that's enough. Maybe that's just like a side note. This is all I have to say on Tolkien. But to get back.
C.S. Lewis is better of the two. So far.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, I actually read the Narnia books. I could not get through Lord of the Rings. But to return to Roald Dahl, yeah. So you were talking about Wonka being sad. That definitely comes out more in the book than in especially the 71 adaptation in...
Well, because Gene Wilder can't be sad, like, physically. Like, right. He can't portray a sad
No, it doesn't work.
More than, like, a scene, you know?
Yeah, which is, like, pretty much just the last... Like, that when they introduce the elevator is when you get a hint of the sadness from Gene Wilder. Of, you know, yes, you know, I know I can't do this forever, but an adult would muck this up, which is why I need to give it to a kid. Which again, that's sort of where I wanted to go with this. Speaking to this, I don't. It was an interesting kind of. I don't know that I would how to categorize this. Ultimately, it's intelligible to me as Roald Dahl is writing for children, and so he's playing into this conceit of, you know, there's only, you know, there can be a kind of bond between children and an adult who's childlike in a good way, not a creepy way, that creates problems psychologically maybe for that adult in adult society, but it doesn't in and of itself inherently have to be problematic. But again, that kind of innocence has been so thoroughly lost.
Well, the idea of just being, well, even not even like being weird, just being kind of a jolly nice guy. Like the idea of being
jolly. No, that doesn't end up being weird. Like, no, it is literally weird, which is why I think that like where... Okay, Tim Burton is Tim Burton, and he has this history of working with Johnny Depp. But the Depp Wonka was really just weird, and the weirdness, off-putting in a kind of bad way that, yeah, had kind of pedo vibes in a way that wasn't even. It was. I don't think it was necessarily playing into it directly so much as they weren't shielding you from it in any way. was like the Depp Wonka was just fucking a weirdo. He had none of this kind of lighthearted
jolliness.
Goofiness.
He wasn't jolly.
Yeah, no, yeah. Not at all.
The jolly as the quality of an adult being like charming and kind to children is kind of gone as a thing.
That's what I'm saying. Like people
you can't
read
be that kind of guy.
People read that as pedophilic. That's my whole point. Because that's the world we live in. Because that's the world Jews have created.
Yeah. Also, it's because you know there are. It's also because there is some reality to it. Unfortunately.
Okay. No, it didn't come out on. Okay. Sure. Yeah. Yeah,
no. No. But because of the. Probably massive pornography consumption and creates paraphilias that, you know, escalate to that point. There's a lot going on there. Whew. And also, you know, it's what they did. It's what, you know, Jews do. You know, that's one of their things, right? You know, they like doing that stuff, so it's going to become more common. The, how to say? It's almost related to the lynching thing. Like, a society that has the moral confidence to lynch anybody is, like, pretty good. And pedophiles, as a thing, in theory, you think of a society, oh, like, this is just kind of handled without even, like, you know.
Yeah, why wouldn't you notice that that guy's fucking gone tomorrow and then...
Yeah. But because those guys are... But because we've employed this legal structure...
Right.
It's like, now we're doing this thing, so... Oh, well. We getting more on the Chocolate Factory, or do you want to...
The one last thing I want, was the role of religion, which was also kind of notable. I don't think it was necessarily, it was very much of a essentially culturally Christian sort of not that they had any specific content per se, but the, there were two points, one where Gene Wilder as Wonka says, if the good Lord had intended for us to walk, he wouldn't have invented roller skates or something to that effect, which is, okay, kind of clever and cute, but also, and there was another offhand reference to the Lord or something like that. The line was delivered because was he Jewish? Not that it really matters. I'm not going to be like, you can't enjoy Gene Wilder because he's Jewish. Was he? Do you know?
I think he was.
It
doesn't matter.
It doesn't really fucking matter.
On screen talent, like, have no input on, you know? Like,
right.
The idea of, like, yeah. Anyone in Hollywood who's
son
on
of
the screen.
Gene and William Silberman. So, yeah, both his parents were, or his father was,
It doesn't matter. Like, he's an actor. He's like,
yeah.
If you are doing, like, kind of come at me with, like, oh, you know that actor is Jewish, like, dude, you're retarded. Like, I don't, like, like,
yeah, right.
Or, like, that actor's not Jewish, therefore Hollywood isn't run by Jews, you're also,
yeah,
like,
also retarded, yes.
Yeah, like,
Anyway, the way he delivered both of these lines that stuck out to me were, it wasn't, because, you know, I've heard, essentially, Reddit tier fedora atheists say, you know, if the Lord had intended for us to drink water, he wouldn't have had invented beer or something like that. It wasn't ironic. It was literally kind of with reference to there is a God that I believe in. And so was the other line, the precise line escapes me at the moment. And I hadn't really thought about it before, and maybe I'm reading too much into it, but there was something about the everlasting gobstopper, the connection between individuality, like the whole it's he frames it ultimately as, you know, poor I made this for the poor kids so they'll never need to buy more than one. So there's this economic component, but there's also, as I was saying, this, like, it never goes away, it's everlasting, so it's essentially immortal and it's individual, which makes
also
it
there is, like, some very much Jesus-y stuff, like, you can eat this forever kind of thing, like,
yeah,
you know,
exactly,
like,
exactly.
Loaves
exactly.
And fishes. Yeah.
Exactly, exactly. So it seems to me it's not particularly it's not strictly allegorical. It's not well allegorical in a, you know, well defined sense, but it did seem to be something going on there in terms of this connection between the gobstopper and the soul. Yeah, I think that
also
probably,
it's it, it's. It, it's about, like, you know, capitalist optimism. You know, pre-World War II capital, or, you know, 50s, I guess, too. It's about capitalist optimism. Like, oh, we're going to solve the problems with
a man in a factory. With pro-social capitalism.
Yes. A man in a factory will come down with a product that will, like, make our lives better in, like, actual permanent way. Like, we will, you know, instead of whatever it is we have now, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, and that was the other thing.
If you told someone in the 50s that, like, houses still would be, like, falling down for 30 years, they'd be like, what the fuck? Like, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they did the house as a, like, houses and cars not being, like, extremely, well, houses are not extremely, but, like, cars especially. Like, your car's still fucking, like, you get maybe, after 200,000 miles, you're kind of, you know, you're kind of fucked. Like, I don't know what to tell you. Like, that's, if you told someone in the 50s that, they'd be like, they would think you were, like, a communist agent, you know? Mm. If I came to Detroit and from, like, oh, I'm from the future, and in 70 years, yeah, your cars are still break down fucking all the time. It's, like, a normal thing and costs a bunch of money to fix, and, you know,
they'd None be like, of them fly
oh, you're from, like, the USSR.
Yeah.
You're from the USSR trying to, like, fuck us up. Like, you know, we're going to make a good product here. It's like, no, no, by 1970, you have all given up. Like, by 1970, everyone in this factory will not care. Like, in fact, the, you know, somebody, another country will make a marginally better car and, like, destroy this city. Like, the Japanese will make a car that is slightly better and ruin you guys forever. It's like, okay, well, they would think you're crazy.
Could you imagine telling a World War II veteran that? Well, that was part of, that was obviously,
you know, part of the thing,
part of the thing, right? Yeah, of course. They were in those Jap cars. Yeah, they really, they're very mad. Very, very mad.
Yeah.
On the industrialization note, too, it was another, the, you see this too. I was thinking about this at Christmas, and then the last couple Christmases were, you know, because again, it's sort of everything old is new again. When you have a child, you see things through the eyes of children, and it was funny because even to an extent, when I was growing up, or maybe this isn't actually different. It's just I'm not sure, but it felt like to me at the time that if candy wasn't exactly scarce, then the Christmas songs about lollipops and sugar plums and all that kind of shit hit in a way that they visibly do not hit for my kids. It's like the candy is just omnipresent, ubiquitous. You know, like it's impossible to avoid. It's constantly shoved in your kid's face, and this idea of it as existing in anything like any kind of scarcity. I guess Gucci gourmet candy, like the kind of big, colorful lollipops that, you know, make for nice visual scenery in the film, are, I guess, something of a novelty and relative to other candy.
Relative to the industrially produced mass.
Yeah, you definitely know, an expensive novelty, right? But that's just not, like, the kids don't give a shit about that. You know what I mean? Like, that's not, it's not even really for them, so... Yeah, I don't know. It's an interest. It was just kind of interesting. Is that your experience, or do you were you did you feel you had candy? You feel people was there the scarcity bit?
I think there is. I think one of the defining, I don't guess for me. I assume so everybody had this experience that, like, candy comes in waves, and it's, like, not as good, right? Like, so Halloween, like, when you have a shitload of candy, it doesn't taste as good. When you have, like, you're given one piece of scarce candy. Mm-hmm. It tastes much better than, like, when you're given a shitload of candy for Halloween or Christmas or Easter or whatever. Like, okay, like, Easter candy is fun, but, like, after your fucking fifth, you know, it's like, kind of like, oh, this actually is... Like, it's one of the first lessons in, like, I think scarcity people learn is, like, oh, actually, when I have a lot of candy, it stops being good relatively fast and kind of just, like, you know, eating, like, a fifth chocolate bar, actually, it's kind of almost an unpleasant experience, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Where, like, the first... Or, like, the only... If you only have one piece of candy... It's gonna be awesome, right? Like, it's gonna be great. Like, we're so psyched. But, like, I think that there's an implication with that, that, like, that the book doesn't actually really explore that too much, because I think everyone's like, because Charlie is, like, I think, a poor kid, right? So candy's always scarce.
Right. Yes. Yeah, we didn't even talk about that aspect of
the Grandpa Joe and the refuses to get a job.
But all four grandparents are sharing live in the house. One bed. Yeah, they all live in the same under the same roof, and they all sleep in the same bed.
Is it implied that it is, like, at night the whole family sleeps in the one bed too?
I believe so, yes.
Yes.
Which was not on the, in the film, you know, there's no, like...
Yeah, it's, well, it's too complicated to like, get that
Yeah,
across.
How would you even do that, right? But yeah, as I recall, yes, they all sleep in the room. The house isn't big enough.
It's a one-room house, right? It's like the classic, like, you know... Yeah. It's like there's a kitchen in the one room. There's an oven in the one room. There's a fireplace. There's a there's the bed for everybody.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And but interestingly, the while the only character who's portrayed as really rich is Veruca Salt, there isn't that's not really like the and of course okay her economic status. There's no I don't think there was a counterexample of a rich kid who was also well behaved. And there is an element of yes, this you know just because Charlie's poor doesn't mean he's a you know going to act like a nigger kind of morality vibe to it, but. It's not really an economic critique per se, because the.
I think it's almost more of a bit of a satire, like the element of how all the four grandparents who also don't work, like in reality, like Rollo is a rich guy, kind of poking fun at like the idea of like
the virtuous poor.
You or just British urban poverty in general, like the I'm a working mother and father with our four grandparents at home and one kid, like. It's kind of just ridiculous, like, over, like, I have four bedridden grandparents who I'm supporting is, like, is a ridiculous, like, situation, right? You know? I want to point out one thing that, speaking of that, that I thought, actually, maybe one of, like, the only thing, Walker-related thing that ever actually pissed me off was when I watched the Johnny Depp, one, and the ending, after, like, all the Charlie, you're gonna inherit the factory, blah, 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 whatever. They mentioned that Charlie's dad got a job repairing, like, automation equipment. Like, the automated factory had been automated that he was, like, he's not a chocolate factory worker in the beginning. In that one, he's just, like, some kind of, you know, industrial worker. It's like, oh, yo, and Charlie's dad finally got a job, and it was repairing the automated factory machines, which was such a stupid fucking, like, pissed me off line because, like, well, like, that's, like, the whole point of this is that, like, the whole city is fucking shitty and poor. And that, like, one guy got a job and that he doesn't actually need because, like, his son is now rich.
Yeah, right.
Makes this thing all, makes this, like, I wanted to throw a brick, like, of, like, okay, like, we're not getting it. Like, you, like, it was the most, like, oh, you don't get it of, like, any of the critiques in this movie or product is making. It's like, no, like, it's doing, like, I understand why you can't do, like, capitalist optimism in the Johnny Depp movie, because it made in the 2000s, and, like, that's kind of already gone, and now it's even more so gone, but the idea of, like, that, happy ending just made me want to, like, throw a brick through a wall, like, dude, it's fucking, it's such a dumb line, I mean, it's the only thing that ever made me angry. I didn't actually find the Johnny Depp version too offensive. I haven't seen the Timothée Chalamet, which I put it, intent, you know.
That was good, that's good.
Yeah. That was intentional. I was that before.
Yeah, no, I got it. Very good.
But I'm just gonna see. It's like it's impossible for me to watch Timothée Chalamet without doing just Dune jokes the entire time.
Right. No. Yeah. It makes it entertaining. The Depp one. I don't think it was.
It's fine.
It's.
I found the Oompa Loompa stuff like
aspects. Yeah, little, the Oompa Loompas. It was okay. It was you know for what
it's
was.
It's a Spy Kids ass movie. To be honest, it's a really Spy Kids movie. Like Spy Kids ass movie with all like the fucking. Special effects that are kind of like dumb, but whatever.
Yeah, it's okay. It just doesn't. I mean, the main thing to me was how weird and off-putting Johnny Depp was. He wasn't even trying to reinterpret Wilder. He was just doing some very.
It was shot aggressively to make him weird. Like
yes.
Extreme
the palette was very
his,
dark.
Like,
yeah.
Extreme close-ups on a man's. White makeup face is always going to look weird. There's no, like, cool way you can shoot that. That doesn't come off as, you know?
Strange and off-putting, yes.
Like, putting up pale white makeup on a man's face and then zooming in on it is, yeah, it's, like, okay, yeah, this is weird. Yeah, like, just the way it is.
Yeah, did you, I think I'm wonked out. Do you have anything else on it? Or
no, I do kind of. I'm glad. I think we have enough of the tank to do a whole Roald Dahl episode. Because
oh
I
yeah,
have
for
Roald
sure.
Dahl,
yeah. Well, I wouldn't I even. Me too, but I wouldn't it. Even. I would want to separate probably Matilda from the witches and the BFG. You could probably put those together. And then there's others. I mean, yeah, I'd have to think about how to, you know, what to hit and how to structure it. But definitely, I would want to talk more, do more Roald Dahl. Yeah, talk more about Henry Sugar, too. I'm a big fan of what's going on there.
I'm a big fan of the BFG as well. I also have read like his weird stuff that like didn't like his there's a book of his that I had as a kid that was his like cut for time stuff, like things that weren't quite finished when he died or was wrapping things up, or and he has some weird stuff that I kind of want to talk about, but also
I definitely didn't make that cut for a reason. Yeah, of course, but then that gives all the more reason to analyze it and take a look at it. So yeah, it's
big doll guy here for sure.
Yeah, no, me too. So
I also kind of want to do a who you think is the most based or least. I want to do like doll versus C.S. Lewis versus Tolkien. Like I think they all kind of operate in the same space, right? And some of them are just straight better than others, right? Or like I want to compare their, because they're all subtly different philosophies for sure. And Dahl, I think, is actually the best. Dahl of the three, like Dahl is the most. Chad.
Yeah.
Well, the most. I find his morality more compelling. C.S. Lewis is better than Tolkien, but it's kind of low bar. And C.S. Lewis has his own problems. I do want to like deep dive into these, you know, inter and post war British children's authors that have had massively outsized cultural impact. All three.
This is a note to close on. And as a general point, is the fragmentation of children's media, I think, has been very interesting to watch.
But also, it's kind of nice that we're going to keep getting Narnia and Trial of Forever.
Right, before everything got shitty, and this is what we got.
The thing is, because they're like ingrained as like one of the good possible scripts. Like, there's a new Narnia in the pipeline right now, too, I think.
Really?
Like, you're going to keep getting Narnia. Okay. And like Narnia is hard for them to fucking... They can probably put maggots in there.
Yeah, blacks, well, but, where? I mean, how? Like,
well, all of the villains.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, exactly. There's not much room for...
Yeah.
I guess you could, make them all black or something, but whatever. We'll see, I guess. Anyway, yeah. Well, this has been iLetter Media. Hope you're all doing
ready
well.
Get excited for G Letter Media.
Yes, and for next Bakhmut, looks like House of Yar is heating up. So we'll have some updates on the National Institute for Geopolitics review soon, but in the meantime, take care, everybody.
I'm an MK Ultra victim. There's poison in my system. I'm an MK Ultra victim. There's poison in my system. I'm an MK